Welcome to the Autistic License Podcast. I'm Leo in London.
I'm Shauna, and I'm in Carrickfergus in Northern Ireland.
We invite you to listen in on our conversations as we experiment with unmasking in an autistic space. We talk about what it means to discover we're autistic as adults, especially with established careers as therapists. We want people to know that autistic therapists exist and to broaden the conversation about neurodiversity. You're so welcome to join us, whoever you are and wherever in the world you are. We hope you'll find something of interest and connection here. We've been talking a lot about our neurodivergent identities and our autistic identities. In fact, that's mostly what we talk about when we have these conversations. And there are shifts around there are shifts around how those parts of my identities kind of move about each other within me. And I think I experienced one of those today because these things stay on my mind every now and then, especially after we've had these conversations. And you sent me a clip, a little shot of a page from the Neuroqueer Heresies book.
That's right, yeah.
This morning, which kind of, I don't know why you sent that particular bit, but it really landed with how I've been thinking about how others see me as an autistic person and how subconsciously, God, this is complicated to make into words, isn't it? Words, sentences, speaking.
It's hard stuff. The way that you're saying it just is because it's hard stuff. It's hard to find the words for, but it's very traumatic stuff because of what you're about to, well, you're talking about. I think you're about to say, okay, context is the reason I sent you that.
Yes.
The funny, wordy reason why I sent you that is that we were talking last night about so I went away and thought, is it autophobia or is it autistophobia? I needed to settle in my mind what the word actually is. And so it's because we were talking about the idea of what actual internalized ableism is autistic context. So I needed to look that up because I needed to know, is it autophobia or is it autistophobia? So I looked that up. Now, I'm sure that some people say autophobia, but Nick Walker says autistophobia. And because I looked that up, then I just photographed that page and sent that to you. So that's why that page.
Okay. And I think we shall probably stick part of that quote at least in the show notes for reference.
Of course, yeah, of course.
And with the page reference, you know, to the book.
Yeah. Neuroqueer Heresies by Nick Walker. Read it.
Well, that goes for me too, because my reply to you was, and this is why I need to read all of those books behind me, because I've got a lovely big bookcase full of stuff. And as I've said at least three times on this podcast over the weeks, my autism makes me buy all the books and then my ADHD stops me reading any of them. It's a neat phrase, but it's a poor excuse, actually. It's not like I've never read a book in my life. I just... There is a resistance to spending a chunk of time on just one thing because it will stop me doing other things. And it's a fallacy. It's nonsense.
Well, I think I'm going to have to follow through on my threat to start sending couriers to your house
to take them
to me. And then in so doing, they will get some movement. And
yes, there'd be
them,
scarcity and then, anxiety will probably kick in and I'll start devouring them quickly before they disappear. That's not a bad idea, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm half serious.
I know you are. And what we were so this links in
at least in my train of thought and my kind of emotional response to thinking about that, this links into the double empathy problem. Do you remember the bit of that conversation? So this was kind of about how I have noticed that when my autistic self is noticed or referenced in conversations with others, even if it is with curiosity or compassion or whatever, I still do a version of apologizing for it. Is that too strong? Or empathizing with another?
Playing down?
Sorry?
You said apologize. Is it like playing down or?
No, I think it's to do. So this is the reason I think we tied it in with double empathy problem was because my natural instinct is to say to somebody who notices something about my demeanor, behavior, character, traits, whatever, is to kind of empathize with them. Yes, I understand that that must seem weird to you.
Oh, okay.
Or yes, I can understand why when I do that, it's incongruous or uncomfortable. Which is fine. That's a conscious social skill in being able to, you know, empathize, put yourself in the other person's shoes and see how you are to them and let them feel comfortable that you understand that, even though what it's doing is highlighting difference. But it's rarely mutual, if ever. So that's what brings up the double empathy problem, because it's not really the double empathy problem. It's the one and a half empathy problem.
It's the autistic person is more empathic than the non-autistic person.
And the reason for that is it is statistically sensible. We have much more exposure to neurotypical people than neurotypical people have exposure to autistic people.
It's marginalized, but that is marginalization. And you're saying it in a kind of those poor neurotypicals, they're not exposed to.
No, I'm not. People,
so
no,
they
no.
They can't learn. But actually.
I wasn't saying that. But
okay, well,
there is an undercurrent. No, you're right. There's an undercurrent of it. And that's kind of what I'm talking about, is that in my own reactions and behaviors in those conversations, there is an undercurrent of internalized ableism, in that I think it's okay that I can understand and explain things from their point of view, but that's not reciprocated. And again, I'm doing it again now. I understand why it's not reciprocated. I understand why that seems to be more difficult.
Yes.
This is very conceptual. I hope this isn't too.
Well, what I'm going to do is bring in. I was at a conference and there was a black person speaking, and that black person was being exactly what you're saying to a predominantly white audience. And actually, he was being so understanding of how uncomfortable they were, but excessively so, to the point that then I felt uncomfortable on his behalf. And a black member then of the audience, she got up and had was righteously indignant about the situation, and she got removed because it was black anger is not okay, but black people coming in and actually being nicey,
yes,
walking on eggshells with the white audience to try and support their very, very beginning empathy as to what it's like to be a black person. But whenever she actually was authentically and totally righteously and full of justice, and she wasn't inappropriate, she wasn't threatening anybody, but so often people get offended by, and the stereotype is black people's anger, but the other thing is autistic people's meltdowns, autistic people's feelings. It's the same thing. It's like we're allowed to go in and be really articulate and explain, now I know I'm a little bit much, and let me explain, I know I might flap a little bit, I'm sorry if that makes you uncomfortable, yes, I don't give you eye contact, I'm so sorry, I'm sure that makes you feel really whatever, but actually when an autistic autistic person comes in and just goes, "This is too fucking much for me," and starts, you know, standing up. And I'm wrong there because I said fucking much and that could offend people. But, you know, when an autistic person is just overtly autistic, like say they make a noise in the middle of something, or they feel a need to wander around a classroom because actually their body is in pain, then that is not acceptable and they have to be told to leave the room. You know, it's the same kind of stuff. It actually, like, we make ourselves so small and so acclimatized and accommodated to the prevailing culture that it's actually inappropriate. It's actually just mean to ourselves or not honoring of ourselves.
I'm pulling up the quote just to see if there's anything that I want to kind of
I ran away with that actually.
Beautifully what you did was contextualize that in the real world, and maybe you've just now done a version of what you were describing. You apologized for running away with it. And I wonder if what you meant by running away with it is you got quite angry.
I did. And I kind of was just like, because I didn't want, on your behalf, I didn't want you to play something down and make it more palatable or, you know, more polite, you know, when actually it's offensive. To be treated with autistophobia. I haven't actually decided which one I prefer. I know which one Nick Walker uses. I haven't decided whether I prefer.
If you say autophobia, though, that sounds... Autophobia sounds like an automatic phobia, you know, generally.
Yeah.
It sounds like auto. So I'm guessing that's why they...
Autistophobia.
Yeah, yep. I think that's probably why they settled on the longer one.
Yeah, probably.
I'm going to quote, I'll read the quote out and we can put it in if we want to, shall I?
Yeah, okay.
There's a siren again outside my window.
I can't hear.
Maybe that's useful. The idea that an autistic person can be somehow separated from the autism is an autistophobic fantasy. It's a fantasy that appeals to those whose autistophobia runs so deep that on some level they see being autistic as incompatible with being fully human, and therefore can only see an autistic person as human by pretending that there's a non-autistic... Sorry. Now it lands. And therefore can only see an autistic person as human by pretending that there's a non-autistic version of the person somehow hidden under the autism.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah, that's what's... And it was a beautifully chosen paragraph for you to send me, actually, because that is exactly what I've been experiencing, what's really landed in my, you know, my experience of my place in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
That. And I'll bring in my therapist head here as well, because in my practice, this happens so often that an autistic person, perhaps speaking professionally at least, to another autistic person for the first time, i.e. me, means that we get to focus on our autistic experience fully. And that's uncomfortable if you haven't done that before. And the reason I bring that context up is because what I will hear some of these people saying to me is... But I don't want everything to be about my being autistic.
Oh, yeah.
And I get that, because whatever your difference is, or the thing that marks you out either to yourself or others, you don't want to only be identified, you know, you don't want that to be your entire identity. In fact, to go back to that quote, to be fully human.
Yes.
But in the opposite way round, you don't want that to be the only thing that, that is, you know, so there's a discomfort about making all the conversation about a person's autistic experience. So they may well say to me, I don't want everything to be about autism, or I don't want anything about to be about me being autistic. And my response to that is it isn't. But it also is, because everything you experience, you experience as an autistic person.
Yeah.
And so there's an acceptance to be had of both sides of that coin. On the one, and this is happening to me right now, and has been for a couple of years, you know. Part of that acceptance of me as an autistic person is that everything that I experience is an autistic experience, because that's what I am, just as I experience everything as a white human or as a male. It's as intrinsic as any other label that I might apply to myself. And therefore,
any other identity.
But we are used to probably all the very visible things about us, such as our gender or our perceived gender, that it's taken for granted almost. And it's all, you know, it's totally intertwined in our language about how we refer to people and their experiences, but through the prism of their identities in whatever layers. What we're not used to is talking about I am, because it's what I do for a living. But, you know, it's talking about our autistic identity as being as profound as any of those other things, any of those other strands of our identity.
Yes.
And that's uncomfortable for people. And so that's why I kind of, the intervention for me in therapy is it doesn't comprise your entire identity, but everything is about your experience as an autistic person, as well as...
Gender, all the other markers,
race, culture, etc., etc.
Could go anywhere with that. Because Lana said to me really recently, "Do you and Leo talk about anything else apart from autism?" and I said to her, "Well, you know, like, we might kind of consciously talk about it in a kind of a way that brings words out of it. But of course, but we talk as autistic people." And I said to her, it's the same as me and you, and her.
Yes,
like, we don't talk about autism, really, but we are autistic. So everything that we talk about is autistic.
Yes.
And everything that we do things is autistic. But what's different is that we are finding the words and making it explicit. And she wanted to push a little bit more on that. And I said I saw a friend on Sunday, and I spent 3 hours with my friend. And my friend is a therapist, and I said, well, you know, in the same way, and she said, and then she was pushing a bit harder, and she said, well, tell me this, do you ever have a conversation where you don't talk about autism? And I said, well, I mean, that's hard too, because what about this example of my friend? I was with her for 3 hours, and Lana knows this friend, and I was like...
And this friend is a therapist, as you said, but is neurotypical.
But it's neurotypical.
As far as I know.
Okay. Yeah, and I said, but like, with her, you know, I can't say that we ever have a conversation that doesn't reference the fact that we're therapists, but you wouldn't ask me, do you talk to her about anything other than therapy? You know, that doesn't say that it's not context, it's not, I mean, I guess that's identity, and well, it's role, maybe it's not identity, but I mean, we both have done this for a long time. So, you know, it's something that's there, but our whole relationship, our whole friendship is not about being therapists. But it's not fair to kind of say, oh, is that all you two talk about? Because it's absolutely not. We talk about many, many, many things. So, it's maybe not exactly the same, because obviously being a therapist is not the same as being autistic, but it was trying to get across that actually, you know, when people get talking, if they've got a common interest, that will usually feature, but it's not all that it is. But everything that they say goes through those lenses. And I guess for me, that's the therapist thing. When you have a friend who's also a therapist, the way that you talk is flavoured by their therapeutic awareness. So my friend will talk to me as my friend, and she's obviously applying her vast experience as a therapist to me and my well-being and my situation as I am with her. So you can't separate from that. Well, I guess a better way to talk about that with it's a female friend is, let's take away the therapist thing and let's talk about as women. Me and her can't talk to each other except through the identity markers as women. And of course, we'll talk about our experience with health and well-being as women, you know, primarily in a different way than what I will talk to you about. That doesn't mean that all me and her talk about is the fact that we're women, but it is arbitrary to say, is that all you two talk about? Because, like, no, it's not, but it's always there. It's always...
That is the mind that I'm speaking with.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That is the person, that is the identity, and that will change what's going to emerge. But the bits about specific women's experience are not the only thing in the relationship, but we might find words to describe them in the same way as you and me might find words to describe being autistic.
And so beautiful, beautiful. That's exactly the right analogy there, because again, it's explicitly visible, your gender in this particular case. It's not, I know it's not always, but it's not. It doesn't need to be challenged, because as we know, it's just built into the language in a way that neurodiversity isn't yet. I mean, we have language and it's developing. It's brand new, comparatively speaking, and therefore it feels incongruous. And I know that there are people around, autistic people, who are especially late diagnosed as adults, as we are, where that is a sudden change, a sudden visible change in how we are, how we explore and lean into that identity and accept it and talk about it in a way that we didn't before.
Yeah.
And that is uncomfortable for some people.
Yeah.
And, you know, at its, well, I don't even know if it's extreme, but autistophobia is a description of a seemingly natural aversion to somebody displaying too from the neurotypical person's point of view, too much. Why does everything have to be about that? And it's not that everything is about that, it is that everything is through that. And
it's really, you know, this. I just am so, you know, I'm so into words. You're so into words as well. But earlier on, you said a version, and you said not. I mean, a version. Yeah, yes. And I was going, but a version works as well.
Yeah, you're
and
right. You're
now,
right.
Of course, like,
there it is again. There it
later,
actually is.
Said it as a version, which is actually accurate. Thank you, Freud. I was thinking something else there. Is it like, say someone who, you know, is a woman and they start to embrace a certain flavour of femininity, you know, maybe they start to become more aware, they embrace their sexuality and they start to dress in a different way. They start to, just express themselves more fully. They were always the women. They were always, always there. But people were used to them looking a certain way or being very demure or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then a woman begins to, embody her, other aspects of herself, and she changes her look and her way of being. And people are like, tone that down. Don't like that. Actually, I liked the version that you were before. That didn't really threaten me. You were just fine like that. What are you doing? And it's like, actually, they're invalidating who she certainly is now and who she maybe always was, but was not able to express, because she was suppressed and shut down. And so people are saying, I'd rather have the version of you that didn't like yourself very much and, didn't wear the clothes you really wanted to wear and covered herself up and did things like that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same, because that is who that person really was. You've always been autistic. Mm-hmm. You just have been masked and shut down.
That's right. Yes. Mm. Yes. That's a much better analogy than my quite clumsy one that I've been using recently, because I'll stumble across a very obvious clumsy analogy and then I'll just repeat it over and over because it seems to make the point. And my one is somebody who is a wheelchair user and have been all their lives, and then somebody gives them a magical medical treatment and they suddenly gain full use of their legs, and which is a wonderful thing for them, but it has some side effects, this medicine, and it makes them a bit grumpy. It makes them a bit less tolerant of certain things. Nobody would say to that person, actually, could you stop taking that medicine now and go back into your wheelchair? I much preferred you then. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't do that. And again, we're back to visible and invisible disabilities as a...
But you might imply it. if some people may not actually explicitly say that to that mythical person, but they might. The mythical word just reminded me of my two other new words.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And yes, I'll make a little note and we'll come back.
Okay. People might not actually say that, but how many people actually get treated that way whenever something, like any operation that people have that, just allows them to live more fully, like your examples, it's not a bad example.
I've got a real one, haven't I? I have had weight loss surgery.
Yeah.
I did two things within 5 years that are almost guaranteed to end marriages. One is to train as a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. There's a huge divorce rate for people who do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is to have weight loss surgery. Both of those have, I believe, and I need to check this and edit this stat out if it's wrong, a higher than 50% rate of relationship failures.
Okay, I don't know what the stats are. I know that, I guess, therapy training will bring up so much stuff. And if the other person is not also maybe working on their stuff, then...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yes. I get that. But tell me about that.
Well, the weight loss surgery thing again, but it says it's very similar. It's a change of identity.
People.
It's a suddenly your confidence does gain because people's reaction to you changes. I mean, I wish it didn't. I wish that people's, the high regard they might hold you in should have really nothing to do with weight or appearance, but it does for many people. And that has an effect on boosting confidence. And again, for whatever reason, if somebody's confidence in a relationship suddenly changes and grows.
Yes.
That's problematic for relationships. And so there is a comparison there about.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
About those kinds of shifts of identity. And it's just that one of those is really visible.
Uh-huh.
But the other one isn't. It's just attitude. And that, you know, if you don't understand the experience of discovering your massive part of your core self and really living within it, which is what, for me, an understanding of my neurodivergence is doing, it can just seem like I've suddenly got a little bit above myself, a bit too cocky.
Okay, yes.
Up myself. And a bit obsessed by this new thing that didn't exist before, which of course it fucking did.
Yeah.
And to go back to the psychotherapy training, actually, I mean, that was one of the first things that was said. This training will change you, I remember being told, and not everybody's going to like that change.
Yeah, we actually said that bit before. I think we must have talked about that. Well, we didn't talk about it like this, but I remember us talking about that thing about psychotherapy changing and not everybody. Anyway, go back. So I am still on, because I've really gone with this idea of what you're describing about the weight loss surgery. So is it that the person who has the surgery, in this case, if we're talking about you, like, you would then obviously, like I said about my example of the woman, you would then obviously be able to embody in a different way. You would be embodying in a different way your very self. And that would then, you've said that would cause other people to see you differently, and you to see yourself differently. But where's the correlation with neurodivergence? Or is it just that then other people would not have you in the same place as you used to be? And is it then like a threat? What is it?
There's quite a lot of potential threads there, actually. I'll talk about why I mentioned it in the same breath, because of what the similarities for me in my own experience, which was both of those shifts of identity gave me greater confidence in who I am.
But then you said, like, what that does to other people who might want to keep you as you were.
And so the difference between the two, I think this is the point I was making. I'm losing the thread now, but the one is very visible and kind of gains you compliments. Oh wow, you look amazing, etc., etc. And so there is a congruence between any more confidence that I might display.
It's congruent
with a visible difference. Of course, he's more upright and more sure of himself now, or more sociable, or whatever. But this other shift, this realization of neurodivergence, and in my case, actual diagnoses, although we know that that's not necessary. All you see is the change in confidence. All some people will see will be a change in attitude, confidence, for no visible reason, perhaps. I'm doing what we said at the beginning now. I'm putting myself in the shoes of the neurotypical person observing.
The behaviour would also change, because as we become more confident and less traumatized, then the masking organically diminishes and we do behave in more autistic, in inverted commas, ways. So like it's not just an attitude and a confidence thing. It is actually like more obvious to people that we're autistic because we're not.
Yes, that's the other thing. Yes, we become more autistic. And now that is not a literal explanation. Of course, we're exactly the same amount of autistic.
But we're not as traumatized because
we don't mask so much.
That's the same thing. Yeah, we mask this because we're not traumatized.
Thank you. Yes.
But what I'm noticing, and I know that you did not intend for me to spin off into all of this, but I just have, is that with the weight loss, the key difference is that people affirm it because it kind of fits with the so-called normative ideal of how you would be in society, which is, you know, slimmer.
Yes, correct.
So actually people are affirming that and saying this is great. But actually when you become more autistic and you start behaving in ways that are not, that are not welcome and not what everybody wants to be like everybody does not want to be like that, then that is totally different. You know, so they might be able to appreciate that. And of course, they might be a bit jealous because maybe you might look better than them after you have the surgery. But nobody's going to be like thinking that way about you being out and behaving autistically.
Two things then that have come out that to cycle back. One, I made the note that you've got two mythic related words that you wanted to talk about.
I actually said to do that. It just felt really like.
But it was exciting for you.
The tracks in my mind just were crashing.
The
ADHD tracks in my mind were crashing at that moment,
and the word fascinated autistic parts of our minds.
Yeah,
so important. Language is so important to us and the nuances of it that we, so many of us, and this is a stereotype that just turns out to be largely valid for many people.
Yeah.
Is that delight and joy in language and words?
So I think probably the more important thing is kind of maybe how the tracks in the mind go and how, like, it just feels like there's going to be a complete glitch and a complete crash if I don't find a way to, like, name it but then get help to, like, switch back to the track, or else I'll just be away on that one.
Understood.
Which is what happened. The words, because now maybe people are actually interested. The first one is chthonic. Which means pertaining to the underworld. And the second one, I cannot remember, but it was to do with Snow White. And, well, I told you, you said, how did that come up? And I said it was to do with Snow White. And it was to do with, like, being, it was another word for selfish, but it was a particular solipsistic something like that, maybe. And I said to you, do you know this word? Don't look it up.
I'm not looking the word up. No,
I said that to you. And you said,
right.
You said,
yeah, solipsistic was that word.
Solipsistic. Yes. And you said, yes, I do actually know that word. Yes.
Spell the chthonic one, though, because if I look it up in our WhatsApp stream, the other word will come up.
C-H-T-H-O-N-I-C. It is solipsistic, though.
Is that the other word?
That's
okay.
That's what it is. It was new to me, not to you. But you didn't know the chthonic one either.
No.
That was helpful. There was words that you were using. Again, this is the words thing. But there's a word, strident, that you were using. And I wanted to go into that. And I don't know why I wanted to go into that, or I wanted you to go into that. Because I must have had some kind of a hint from that it could be sort of taken forward or unpacked a bit more. And I think it was just in terms of, like, embracing being your autistic identity, and that you felt more strident.
Strident, yes. It's a few steps away from a word like militant or something, isn't it, for some people, that it can sound aggressive, pushy, insistent, relentless. These are that's the thesaurus in my brain. It's not, that's not a thesaurus because those aren't synonyms, but you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean.
And I think what it what I'm thinking about there is a development or a step on from the thing that we've talked about before, where we are more confident in asking for our needs to be met.
Yeah.
And parallel to that, reclassifying some of the things that we call wants as needs.
Yeah.
And so when I think about feeling more strident about my identity, then maybe the word is insistent. I'm less likely to be tolerant of people subconsciously, with no conscious intent, talking to me in a way that implies that I am less than, or that I perceive as being spoken to as less than, which loops back to that lovely quote from Neuroqueer Heresies again. Not fully human.
And that, but and also you saying that you perceive as that is also in some ways casting doubt on whether your perception might be wrong, because of course you're just an autistic person who can't perceive reality.
you could argue that. I think I would just broaden it out as to say, as a human being, I can only rely on my perception, and I cannot rely that that's, because it's by definition subjective and not objective. There is no objective truth, etc.
Yes, you will always be more reasonable than me, and I will always say the most provocative and offensive versions.
And I admire and am, you know, a little jealous of that quality.
Mm.
Because that also sums up, you know, that difference between us that you've just, which I don't entirely believe across the board, but in certain things I think you have a point. That is something that I move toward.
Mm. Yeah, well, and that goes back to me wanting to be less annoying and offensive.
Well, those are very subjective, self-critical words, which I have a problem with when you use them.
Mm. But there's probably something in it. If you can teach me to be a bit less offensive just for the sake of it, I can teach you.
And you can. I think you do.
Be a bit. Yeah, I don't know what the equivalent
well,
is.
Well, let's put it this way.
To say it like it is.
What I've been talking about so far for the last half an hour or so is directly related to our friendship and what I get from you.
What do you mean?
Well,
you've lost me there. Why is what we talked about?
Being strident, being less tolerant of...
Okay. Doesn't this really hook in to both of our stuff? Because on one hand, you know, it's... Well, and it hooks into what we're talking about, because there will be people who will think that I'm a bad influence. to use a teenage phrase, because you are a nice guy, and I'm
parking that
not,
phrase to come back to
not a
I
nice
think you
girl.
Mean something. I think you mean something by that, which is about.
I mean that people like you in general. You go out into the world and you are liked. In general, I go out into the world and most people will not like me if I'm myself. Now, I can, and I have lived under an invisibility cloak for it. That was my survival pattern for, you know, many years of my life and in many contexts. So I still won't be likable, though. If I've got my invisibility cloak on, I will go under the radar, but I'll just be a bit of a nothingness. But that's my invisibility cloak. It's not the reality.
You're saying the reality is not likable.
I'm saying that with the invisibility cloak off, you know, I think I've told you this before. For the longest time, since I was very young and able to make my own rules about things, because I mean, I was always autistic. I had this idea that, you know, say I was in a room of 10 people, like two people would just think I was amazing. Like they would just think I was wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe four or five people, and it was always like double. So maybe like, so let's say four people would think, oh my God, she is so horrible. Get her out of my face. And then like maybe there would be something in the middle that might be like, huh, well, you know, she's okay, you know, or people being like, well, she's all right as long as she shuts up or something like that. So like do you know what I'm going to do? I'm actually going to close my eyes because I don't want any cues coming from you until I finish.
I'm displaying my lack of poker face again, aren't I? Okay. I've turned my camera off, if you like.
We both do it. I don't even do eye contact usually whenever I'm speaking, and I'm not even doing eye contact, but I can still tell because of your body language that you don't like what I'm saying, and I can see the flickers of your body language.
I've just got things to say about the things you're saying. It's not that I don't like it. I'm fascinated by elements of it.
What I'm saying is that since I was young, I completely knew that it's untenable. Even the most likely person, the most likable person in the world, is not going to be liked by everyone. You can't be liked by everyone.
Correct.
And
of course,
that is one of your issues, obviously, because in some level, some of your parts do believe that you can be liked by everyone. I've never had that. So without my invisibility cloak, I still go into the world believing that the majority of people are going to, at best, kind of take or leave me. I don't think nobody's going to like me. I mean, you like me, don't you? There are people out there.
I like you, Shauna. I like you, Shauna.
Thank you. Not that I need that, but I'm just proving my point that there are people, and I genuinely believe there are people that like me. There's probably people listening right now that like me, you know, but there are also going to be, you know, a lot of people that when I'm unmasked and when I'm really myself are going to not like me and have strong feelings of aversion against me. Aversion, again, to use that word. So the clash between us is that you might have thought like 10 out of 10 people would like you, but then maybe you might realise that not everybody is going to completely love you, even if some of your parts believe that they might, you know. So, but people see you as a likable guy. You're nice to people.
So you say. So you know? Keep saying. Okay.
No, I think that they do. Okay, can everybody write in, please? How many people like Leo and find me a bit much? You know, I mean, it's going to happen. I'm sure that I have some people that like me on this podcast. I get that. I'm not a
higher
myself.
Proportion
I feel
than you
like
imagine, I'm sure.
I think that I'm just being realistic. You can talk. You can talk.
I'm just fascinated. Okay. We are we're in Western Europe. We are from the United Kingdom. We are from a society where, generally speaking, except for certain particularly outspoken people who have larger than the average egotistical needs, people don't generally let on that they have a problem with you or they don't like you. I don't mean you, I mean one. So I'm just fascinated about where, even as a child, as you were saying, you get your data from that, you know, 10 people who will... Seriously, this is a genuine question. How are you gathering this data? How did you gather that data? How were you making the... Because you've got really... Because you've said this before and you've used the same numbers. And you know, you're saying you know.
I'm
as if it is
my sensitivity. Like, I could tell. I can tell when people like me. And I can tell when people don't. I know. I totally know. And I really respect, like, 6-year-old me or whatever age it was, where I made those, I really got that. Like, I probably literally looked around a class of 30 and was able to kind of go, okay, here's the statistics here.
Exactly.
Although, as you know, I had a new number. So I had 3T in between 20 and 30, but my P1 teacher did not let me do that. And I had to leave that school.
We probably need to go back to that narrative. No, seriously, but that's an important bit of narrative.
That's an important bit of narrative. But what I'm saying is that at that age, so maybe that was at 4 or 5. So I am going to go for 6-year-old me. You know, 6-year-old me had already worked out. Like, 6-year-old me could count, and 6-year-old me could work out statistically where I stood in a room of 30.
If you were talking to a client, to someone you work with, uh-huh, who was telling you this narrative, uh-huh, surely as a therapist, at least part of you would be saying, well, what you're doing there is building up a narrative to support your view of yourself as being unlikable to most people.
In truth, if a client told me this, I would be like, same.
Please. I don't believe you.
I would. I'm not going to lie to them.
No. Okay. You may well disclose that you have this. You carry the same impression of yourself. But surely you'd challenge part of it as being some kind of.
But no, I still honestly believe that it's not bad. I don't want 10 people to like me. This is where I'm so different to you. 10 people like me.
Well, hang on. There's some assumptions so about how important you think it is to me to be liked by everybody. I'm going to challenge it in terms of I think you're right in essence. Definitely. Please others is a big driver for me, to use transactional analysis terminology. And that I am a people pleaser, or I have been, but that actually is the very thing that's shifting that I was talking about, that we were talking about at the top of this podcast today.
Mm-hmm.
That strident. Is it stridence? Stridency? Stridenality? No, of course not. Doesn't matter.
It does matter.
Oh, yeah, no, it totally matters.
It totally matters. We'll look it up.
So. Yeah. So there is that. That has to shift.
Yes.
It has to shift. I have to care less about that. I have to care less if some people seeing me change in ways that make them uncomfortable. I have to care less about that. Hopefully without losing compassion, mm-hmm, but maybe without sacrificing my own experience in favour of seeing their point of view, or seeing where they're coming from, or imagining what it must be like for them to have me around.
Yeah. 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 And I still think about other people and think about whether I need to put my invisibility cloak on, like, regularly, because I still recognize that without that, I'm going to rub people up the wrong way. So I still try and please.
But that's
well.
A shift. But what you've done there is one of the goals of therapy. One is to care less about the things that we that get in our way, and two is to expand choice as much as possible. And that's what you do there. So masking is a subconscious process that we are unaware of. We don't know we're doing it.
Yes.
But when you were to put on your invisibility cloak on purpose to grease the wheels of communication or help a relationship along, then that's a social skill then. You're choosing to spend that energy
and not
be your authentic self for a period of time for a practical purpose or a social purpose.
Definitely, definitely, definitely. Yes. My invisibility cloak has become a resource that I can put on and off. In the past, there was definitely lots of unconscious elements to it. and that there was a habitual thing where I didn't even know how to take it off. But yes, over time, it has become much more of a conscious resource that I can step on. I kind of, you know, have this idea of like swishing it around.
Can you see it around your shoulders and then pulling it. Yes, it's exactly right.
Glitter. It's glittery.
See-through,
translucent. Yes, you know, yeah. And it just swishes around me like, yeah, kind of like a cape, but it's got a hood as well. So yeah, I can now choose to put it on and go incognito. People can think that I'm just a sweet, nice girl.
This is where I am, which I always see myself, by the way, and this is a comparison I don't think I've ever verbalized before. I see myself as several years behind you on this similar journey of shifting identities, because I mean, chronologically I am. Your awareness of
2018. Yeah, 2018 is whenever I was diagnosed.
Okay. So I'm 4 years behind if we're moving at a similar
younger
pace.
Than me. So yes. You're like 2 and I'm 6. Wonderful.
I like that. Okay. I'll hang on to that piece of imagery. And so I am not at that bit yet, I don't think, generally speaking. I'm sure there are exceptions where I am relishing the newfound social skill of putting on my invisibility cloak. I am still at the stage before that of fully exploring and accepting the fact that I'm different.
You're 2. So you're 2. So 2-year-olds kind of do know a lot, you know? So 2-year-olds are like learning how to say no. They're like, you know, you say something to them, they go,
no!
No!
That's it.
Leila used to do this with her finger, no!
Even though I have no experience of that, that looked like an uncannily accurate impression of 2-year-old Lana.
Oh yeah, yeah. But it also is like what you're doing now in your autistic journey. You're being a 2-year-old, a 2-year-old toddler.
Yeah.
You know, exploring,
pushing at boundaries,
taking risks, and yeah. Yeah,
well, that's really nice. Who knew that that was? Well, I guess you did. That was going to turn out to be such a useful analogy.
I didn't know. I just know my. Those things just obviously come to me because I studied all that stuff and because I had Lana. But yeah, but that's interesting because then if I get to be 6, then I get to be at that stage whenever I'm recognizing my fate, my place in the world, and my 10 people rule. You see, that's 6-year-old me. So you see, it fits.
I think then the inference maybe that I took up was that's not realistic.
No.
The comparison there was that 20% of people like you, 90% of people like me, that's not reasonable.
No, it's not. I don't think that in actual fact 90% might, maybe 80 or 70.
See, you didn't give me a number.
I didn't give you a number, but I think that
you said
maybe
most people. Yeah.
You might want to overestimate it, and I might unfortunately rain on your parade. Like say we were somewhere. We should do this sometime, like if we ever are somewhere together. I'll be like, how many people do you think actually like you in this? and then we can see. I feel like I'm grappling to get at something here where I do feel like realistically it can be almost as harmful to believe one way rather than the other way. It's like that thing of like high self-esteem. You know, what is high self-esteem? Like if it's contingent on other people, then it's not self-esteem at all. I actually did my master's dissertation on this many, many, many years ago. But like this idea of like what is self-esteem actually based on, and if it's contingent on the external factors, then it doesn't even matter. Like, what is high, what is low? You know, half of it's just terror management and things like that. I had all this research. It's probably out of date by now. But the point being that, you know, it's totally unstable anyway. And you need to get a much more internal locus of evaluation, to use a Carl Rogers phrase. You know, and I guess that's relevant as well in what we're talking about whether how many people like you or not. Does it really matter? You know, so this started, I suppose, where, you know, we talked about the effect of each other, effect of you on me, the effect of me on you. But then we kind of then went off, maybe I went off on thinking or on commenting that people wouldn't like the influence that I am on you. But actually, in a deep down, true way, like, that's not really relevant anyway, because it's how you see yourself and your internal locus of evaluation that's the most important thing. It's not how other people see or whether they might blame someone like me or anyone else or anything else, like a book you read, a seminar you watched, you know, anything like that. That just completely misses the point, because we what really matters is what is coming from the inside out, not what someone else is doing or saying to influence us in some way.
That feels like a wonderful ending to an episode.
Or are you looking at me like, wind it up, Fiona?
Well, no, I'm kind of, because that does feel like a nice conclusion.
Yeah, it is. Okay, stop the tip.
Do you really want to say goodbye?
Goodbye. Come on, you do your nice guy.
Shauna doesn't care what you think of her saying goodbye.
Neither does
I want you all to love me, so autisticlicense@gmail.com. I love Leo is the subject line. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Autistic License podcast. You can connect with us via Instagram, Facebook, at autisticlicense.com, or by email at autisticlicense@gmail.com. At this point, Leo likes me to spell the word license because we spell it in different ways in different parts of the world. We spell it L-I-C-E-N-C-E. We also have a thriving Facebook community. You can search for Autistic License Shauna and Leo on Facebook, or you can click on the link in the show notes.